Hola, son. We have 3 weeks left. And for this week, of course, as you are fully anticipating, we will return to the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, also called shamatha, focused on the mind. And now you know by that that just to be focusing on one thought, one image, one memory suffices for focusing on the mind. You don't need to look at all of it, just one fragment is enough. And then another fragment, just like looking at a person's forehead, the chin, the cheek, the nose. Each time you're looking at the face, you don't have to look at the whole face when you observe somebody's face or their body and so on. It's also called taking appearances and awareness as the path. So I won't go at length now. You've heard this, the instructions, you've engaged in the practice. I will make this point though. And that is, it's quite clearly stated in the various instructions from different traditions. They all boil down to the same thing. I've seen just really no differences at all of any significance between, let's say, Gagyupa, Gelugpa, Nyingma, and so on. But the point is that one is looking at the essential nature of whatever comes up. So it's very easy when thoughts, images come up to really be interested in, or at least to have one's attention caught by the content of the thought. Oh, that was about my mother, that was about my house, that was about this, that's about the future, that's about the past, and so on. But this is not the practice. The practice, because this is really not, how do you say, a Vipassana practice to understand the nature of the thoughts in terms of their content and all that kind of business, but just their nature. What type of phenomenon are they? What type of phenomena are they? And so you're really not that interested in their content as such. You're not oblivious of their content, but it's more kind of like just looking through it. So if you're interested in dogs, for example, rather than be interested in this species, that species, this type of behavior, that behavior, just kind of looking into what is it that makes that a dog? You know, kind of its nature. What is it distinguishes it from cats and everything else that's not dog? So it's not analytical, but it's really simple. It's just attending right there to what's appearing, but without interest in its referent, right? So many people find this quite challenging. It sounds simple, that is, when one hears about it, not a complex practice. It's easy to either become bored with all the kind of stuff coming up and think, I've seen this before, this is more of the same old, can't we move out of here into a more interesting neighborhood? But then that means you're really kind of getting hooked more on the content, because after all, the content does get rather boring pretty quickly. Whereas the essential nature, just what is it about the nature of these phenomena that makes the mental phenomena? That, I hope that's clear. It's not complex, and it's not really deep, like, oh, I must be realizing emptiness or something like that. It's just the mere nature of the presence of the phenomena. There is a term that's deeper, and it's worth knowing. It's cittata. You've heard the term dharmata, dharmata. And I've translated dharmata, I've translated it differently over time, but I'm right for the last couple of years, been translating dharmata as the ultimate, as ultimate reality. But the word is interesting. Dharma just means phenomena. Phenomena. But ta makes it an abstract noun. And so, for example, shunyata. Shunya is an adjective, it just means empty. Empty is an adjective, right? Like the cup is empty. But then you say shunyata, and that's that emptiness, right? The emptiness. So it's not particularly about this cup or that cup or another cup. It's just you have a whole bunch of empty cups, they all have something in common. Their emptiness of that is having no content. And so dhammata is, what is it about phenomena that makes them phenomena? The phenomenon-ness, dhammata. Because that ta, T-A with an akron, a long A, dhammata, is just, what is it about these phenomena that makes them phenomena, right? Just as what is about empty, what is it about this empty glass that makes it empty? Well, you know, it's emptiness. That's pretty simple, isn't it? And And so likewise, cittata. Cittata. And finally, dhammata is referring, of course, to emptiness. It is referring to emptiness. It is referring to the very nature phenomena as being on one side of the coin, they're empty of inherent nature. On the other side of the same coin, they are arising as dependently related events, right? Arising independent upon prior causes and conditions. The whole arising independent upon its parts, its qualities. But also the phenomenon, whatever it is, arising independent upon the conceptual designation of it that sets it apart from its environment, that demarcates it from everything that is not it, right? And you really need conceptual designation for that. We have a powerful urge, momentum, habituation to think that phenomena are already defining themselves. They've already carved out their own turf, carved out their own body. They start here and they end there. And then we're just coming in and witnessing the sense that we're somehow passive. We simply see colors, and oh, yeah, but that was already there. We see a person, oh, yeah, but that person was already there. We see a mountain, yeah, but the mountain was, of course, already there. Not quite. Where are those borders? Who created the borders between it and not it? And the Madhyamaka view, middle way view, is it's not already there. Not already there. Not even your own mind. And so the Dhammata is pointing out they're empty of inherent nature. But of course they're present. But they're present independent upon prior causing conditions, independent upon their parts and qualities, and independent upon the conceptual designation of them. And as that is true of dhammata, the phenomenonness of phenomena, with that dual aspect of emptiness, and then the luminosity, the appearanceness of phenomena. Emptiness and appearance. You've heard this one by now. Emptiness and appearance. Emptiness and luminosity. Then likewise for your mind. Cittata. Mindness. And that's not referring just to some kind of global, you know, my mind as some great big monolithic entity. It's your thoughts, your images, your whimsies, your joys and sorrows and desires and emotions and everything else. Each one has its own cittata. Each one has its own nature of being a mental event. And what is that nature of being a mental event? It has the nature of being empty of inherent nature, but also the nature of being a mental event, arising independent upon prior causing conditions, its qualities, and then our conceptual designation of our own minds. Right? And so we're looking right there, and again, Bahia's, the lecture to Bahia, the Dharma talk, the thumbnail sketch, to Bahia, in the seen, let to be just the seen. In the cognized, let to be just the cognized. Keep it really simple. Just keep it slender. Of just what is it, that mindness, that mentalness? What is that? Just attend to that. Okay. So, I always think it's going to be shorter than it winds up being. Never very short. We'll come back to this really, I think, quite stellar presentation from the Shatvajra of Conscious Awareness Tantra, where he lays out so succinctly the types of mindfulness that unfold, that manifest throughout the development of this particular practice of settling the mind into natural state. And this is where we'll go right now. We're about to go in. And the very first one, and we're going to linger there, going to savor it. Before you eat your food, before you eat, you know, get a nice, you know, my nice meal's coming in, but just first enjoy the fragrance. Just haven't seen it yet, but it smells yummy, like mom's cooking in the kitchen. Oh, it looks like she's cooking up a storm. It smells really good. I think I even see I can smell the dessert there too, you know, like that. So we're going to just slip in on that first point of distinguishing the difference between stillness and motion. Keep it real simple. I'm speaking a lot, but when we're actually doing the practice, it's really simple, and I'm front-loading everything so I can be quiet and you don't have to multitask, right? So stillness and motion, remember? A couple of ways of interpreting that. I want to keep it simple today for this session. And that is, we're going to know, subtle body, speech, and mind. Practice a little bit of mindfulness of breathing. There. Calm down. It'll be okay. Calm the turbulence of the mind. And then just let your awareness come to rest in stillness. And recognize when it moves. And when it moves, relax. Because it's moving because you're grasping. Right? It's so simple. Awareness moves because you're grasping. You're grasping because you like it or you don't like it. Because you're hoping or you're fearing. Because you're restless or you're bored. That's what sets us in motion. So, just be still. And recognize when there's motion. When there's motion, relax, release, and return to the present moment. And if you start slipping into dullness, then refresh your interest in being conscious. Restore your awareness of being conscious. And retain that awareness of being conscious. Okay? That's simple, isn't it? Let's practice. 24 minutes. So we had quite an adventure looking at the stage 6, fully past the, what was that? I've forgotten the name. Stage 6. I just remember the numbers. Let's see. Yeah. Pacified attention. Yeah. Tamed, pacified, and now fully pacified is where we're going today. Stage 7. So stage 6 is really a lot of rock and roll. A lot of things happen. And it's time to, you know, it's really a time to sharpen your knife, both for your introspection, your mindfulness. It's tremendously maturing. If one can move through that phase, then again, as I mentioned before, these various signs of progress, some of which you might wish to detour around, really can rise as aids to your practice. But if and only if you practice well. Otherwise, they actually completely block your practice and then send you off in 1,000 different directions looking for some way out of here. You know, whether it's to look for new branches of knowledge or medical treatment or divination or this or that, anything but this, right? But let's imagine that you have moved through there by simply doing the practice, which has been explained already, and you move on to the 7th stage, fully pacified attention. And the what is achieved here is the pacification of attachment, melancholy, and lethargy. Well, you know, that's a very short list for a much larger list. So exactly that whole array of upheavals that are especially manifest, by no means uniquely manifest, because they can occur at any time, as I said yesterday or like last Saturday, but really you're dredging deep now. And so there's just a short list: attachment, lust, craving, greed, desires of all kinds, melancholy, and lethargy. Basically, kind of the basic two imbalances of excitation and laxity, but turbocharged. You've actually pacified them. You've moved beyond them. So when you get to stage 7 relative to stage 6, very peaceful. You really feel you've gone through a lot and matured through the process. And now the power by which it's achieved is something new. In stage 6, it was introspection, which you're sharpening, you're utilizing a lot, but you're sharpening as well. And now when you come to stage 7, it's enthusiasm, virya in Sanskrit, enthusiasm, which is sometimes, I think, rather poorly translated as effort or simply perseverance or energy, which is too vague. It's translated as zeal, which is not bad at all. But the term virya in Sanskrit, or in Buddhist Sanskrit, is really referring to, it's the fourth paramita, the fourth of the 6 perfections. So generosity, ethics, patience, and then this one, enthusiasm. And I translate it as enthusiasm or zeal, either one is fine, because it's not simply perseverance, because that's sheer perseverance is more in the nature of patience, fortitude, forbearance. You know, as the metaphor for that is beating a donkey on the rump to make it go uphill. And you just keep on whack, 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 because it doesn't really want to go uphill, but you whack, 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 and it keeps on going up, right? And so there is we all know there are phases of practice, time sessions where you feel, okay, I've said I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, you know? Not all that enthusiasm, but you want to do it. And so you beat yourself on the rump, and you continue practicing. But by the time you get to stage 7, then what really moves you, and really is now not only moving you, but is sharpening the practice and it propelling you along further in the practice, is enthusiasm. And enthusiasm is defined as taking delight in virtue, whatever kind of virtue, the virtue of giving, the virtue of maintaining a very ethical way of life, the virtue of cultivating patience and forbearance, virtue of developing greater enthusiasm for the practice, meditation, and wisdom, so all 6 perfections. And so while the metaphor of whacking the donkey on the rump to make it go uphill is the metaphor for patience, water flowing downhill is the metaphor for enthusiasm. Okay? That you can just hardly wait to get back to your session. Like I mentioned that one person where it was just kind of bliss for 11-hour stretch, and then, okay, I need to pee. I should get something to eat. Runs off, pees, gives out what you don't need, take when it would, and then she's, boom, right back to the cushion. Not because I should be putting in another 4 hours, like, but gosh, can't I get in another 4 hours? You know, so that's pretty sweet. The practice is going quite smoothly now, but it's getting more subtle, getting a lot more subtle. So enthusiasm is the power by which you achieve this 6th stage. It's enthusiasm that gets you through that 6th stage and gets you up to the 7th stage. But now we see again a balance, and that is what problems persist are subtle imbalances of the attention which are swiftly rectified. Subtle imbalances of the attention means that now that there is a parity between the level of excitation and the level of laxity to which you're still prone. Okay? So I explained on Saturday the nature of subtle excitation. Remember, it was like the radio station where you're really on the station, but you're just getting a bit of static, a little bit of noise from other station, but really overwhelmingly you are on your station. But now, as Tsongkhapa points out, among all of the imbalances that arise that need to be surmounted as you're practicing shamatha, proceed along the path of shamatha, the most subtle, the most difficult to identify even as a problem is subtle laxity. And words don't really cut it here. Words don't really capture it. I will not be able, even if I could speak for an hour or 10 hours or 100 hours, I couldn't simply convey to you in words, this is subtle laxity. I mean, I use some words and not a whole lot of them. So let's see how it goes. So subtle laxity, the object appears vividly, but the attention is slightly slack. Well, what does that mean? I mean, that's it. You can't really do much better than that. The object appears vividly. You're spot on. It's clear, radiant, luminous, and all of that. But the attention is slightly slack. So what does that mean? It's all relative within your system. And so unless you're already up there, stage 6, stage 7, around there, unless you know what it's like to have phases when you're completely free of subtle laxity, then you won't know what it's like when subtle laxity comes in. When you're free of subtle laxity, it's just razor sharp. If we take an analogy of practicing shamatha by way of focusing on a Buddha image, okay, generating a mental image of the Buddha in your mind, when you're free of subtle laxity, that image is there. It's three-dimensional. It's sharp. It's brilliant. It's high focus. Again, I'm using the image of like an LCD screen or a really good television. It's bright. It's very, very focused. And it's really high resolution. So in your mind's eye, you're seeing that image about as clearly as if you were seeing it with your eye as a physical object. Okay, really clear. Now, even long before you achieve shamatha, you may have experiences like that. Many of you have already, even if you can't visualize all that well. And it's called hypnagogic imagery. You know, that type of imagery that arises when you're falling asleep, but you're not quite awake, not quite asleep. And a number of you have this, whether it's just a little slide here and there or a little video clip, but it's so clear, and it can be multimodal. You can see a stream and also hear the stream. Or you might have the fragrance of the grass around the stream. But it's so vivid. You're like, wow, what a terrific visualization. Except you're not visualizing. It just comes up spontaneously. Or many, if not all of us, have had dreams of that sort. I remember I had one dream some time ago where it was so vivid. But the question arose, gosh, could this be a dream? And then I looked at it again and I said, nah, no way this can be a dream. It's just too clear. It's just too real. No way. And it was. I figured that one out only after I woke up. And so there it is. Well, what's happening there is you have sold. Here's my interpretation. I think it's a pretty safe interpretation. Whether it's in hypnagogic imagery or whether it's in an extremely vivid, I didn't say lucid, but high resolution, realistic dream, in either case, even if you're not very good in visualization, how can that be so incredibly clear, high definition and so forth? My interpretation is there's no competition. There's no competition. That is the whole, if we consider the flow of your attention being like the water in a river, and you're a civil engineer, and you've gotten all of that water, like the Mississippi or the Amazon or some, the Nile, some great river, to all flow in one channel so it doesn't seep out into a lot of little, little whatever aspects of the delta. If you got it all to flow into one, that would be one very powerful current. Rather than going out into, let's say, six streams, like for your five physical senses and your mental, right? And so that's what's happened here. You get up in stage seven and you are experiencing times when your attention is just enfolding in with total clarity. In other words, it's absolutely not a trance or a stupor or spacing out or just kind of going dull because, and everything's going. No, it's just that all of the clarity of your awareness isn't going into one field, the mental, of course, and there's hardly anything left for the visual, the auditory, and the tactile. Well, that's what happens in hypnagogic imagery. You probably have little or no sense of your body. Your room's probably quiet, so there's no competition there. Your eyes are closed, no competition there. But most importantly, also in terms of the activities of the mind, rumination, all that kind of stuff, that's almost, you've almost slipped into the substrate consciousness. You've also almost slipped into deep sleep, dreamless sleep, but not quite. And then in that absence of competition, these incredibly clear hypnagogic images or an extremely clear dream. Well, this is what it's like here. All right. When you've experienced that, degree of clarity, and now let's come back to the visualization of Buddha image. It's as clear as a hypnagogic image. It's like, whoa, I'm meeting the Buddha, or at least a really good facsimile of the Buddha. And then you see it's not quite that good in your next session or later in the session. It's still clear, but not that clear. Now, relative to your experience, you see, okay, relative to that, this must be subtle laxity. Apart from this, I would say this is just fantastic. My mind's clear, it's stable, it's hunky-dory, maybe I've achieved shamatha, or maybe it's Rigpo, or maybe it's something else really cool. But no, it could have been, you've had tastes of it being better. So I think it's clear, yeah? So that's it, subtle laxity. That's a very subtle one, the most subtle of the imbalances you encounter. And so now you're prone to both, which means, and they're swiftly rectified, but now how, by what means are they swiftly rectified? Well, again, what's really moving you forward now is enthusiasm. But your introspection, which back at stage 4 or 5 was like a butter knife, because all you have to figure out is like coarse, medium excitation and coarse laxity. That's a butter knife, Now up here in stage 7, that introspection, your blade of introspection has to be like a scalpel. Because you're going to have to, and your application of remedy is going to be really, really fine. That is, you're looking at subtle excitation and you just tweak it. Just that slight little bit of relaxation, that tiny bit of loosening up. Relax, release, return, but really subtle. And then, subtle laxity. Oh my goodness, that is subtle. So I have to give a bit. I have to increase the pitch a little bit. Don't do it too much. Oh yeah, okay, that'll do it. So both your introspection to even identify them, and then the way you balance it out. Very subtle. And people. I've had a number of students, not many, who've achieved this state. And they linger. They linger, and not because they're having a really hard time, like, big paroxysms, upheavals of this or that or the other thing. It's subtle. That's why they linger. It's subtle. And if they get a bit frustrated, if they can't quite sharpen that introspection to rise to this challenge, they kind of flatline there. And then something else comes to mind. Oh, maybe I should do this. And then, boop, off they go. You know? Not any big trauma, not any big disillusionment, nothing like that. It's just that they couldn't quite continue. I think, as I've pointed out a number of times, this ninefold path of, nine-phase path of shamatha, leading to the tenth shamatha itself, has some similarities with the macrocosm of following the five paths and the ten bhumis, the five bodhisattva paths, for example, the ten Arya bodhisattva bhumis. Only in broad strokes, of course, they're utterly different. One is culminating in enlightenment, the other one's just a little, you know, the Volkswagen, a little shamatha. But the following point, I think, is really quite, suggestive. And that is, if you go right back to your kind of classic Mahayana Buddhist teachings on the five paths and the ten stages, which all four schools study, I mean, the real good scholars of Sakya, Gelug, Nyingma, Gagyu, all of them study it. And there are minor points of debate, but there's an enormous amount of consensus. That you have these five paths. So you become a bodhisattva. You develop your bodhicitta, your bodhicitta, such that it becomes spontaneous, uncontrived, it just flows, it is really your mind, right? So when that happens, then you're a bodhisattva. When you're a bodhicitta, arising from great compassion, great loving kindness, and stabilized and refined with shamatha, so that it just flows naturally. Anything can spark it. It's not like you're always thinking, I mean, it'd be silly, you're always thinking out throughout the course of the day, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. No, you have to put some butter on your toast, you have to cook your eggs, you have to do whatever you're doing. So your mind isn't like a one-track moron. But it is there, it's the undercurrent. It's your motivation of motivation for going and buttering your bread and cooking your eggs and so forth. But also a point of kind of the sign that this bodhicitta has really become, it's called jime, and that is uncontrived, unfabricated, just like that, is that kind of anything can spark it. You can see a dog that's suffering. You can see a worm that's struggling on the pavement where it really doesn't want to be. It doesn't belong there. And you can just see anything. Just so many little, there are just many, many triggers. The world is just filled with triggers that will just naturally arouse effortlessly your bodhicitta. Okay? So from that point, when you've now become a bodhisattva, okay, that's when the other bodhisattvas throw a big party. Oh, we got a new member. You know, oh boy, yee-hoo! They start throwing flowers in the air. So you're part of the bodhisattva club. Then from that point, until you become an Arya bodhisattva, you move through the path of accumulation, through the path of preparation. It's called by different translations. I think it's okay. And then the path of seeing, you reach the path of seeing. Everybody, it's darshana marga, it's easy, path of seeing. But it's the path of seeing, which is to say you're now, when you reach that point, you have realized for the first time as a bodhisattva this non-conceptual, non-dual, utterly unmediated realization of emptiness. And in so doing, you've achieved the first Arya bodhisattva bhumi, or ground, called the very joyful, raptugavesa. If you're following straight sutrayana, says the classic sutrayana practices, teachings, that'll take you one countless eon. Okay? Takes a while. I describe it quite briefly, but that's one countless eon. It's finite, but kind of don't hold your breath. It takes a while. One countless eon. Okay? So that's from beginning of path of accumulation to beginning of path of seeing. And then you have you're on the first Arya Bodhisattva ground. Then you have the second, third, fourth, right up to the eighth. The eighth is called the pure Arya Bodhisattva ground because your mind is now free of all klesha, mental afflictions, klesha avarana, afflictive obscurations. And so to make that, to traverse those in the normal way, the old-fashioned way, with no Vajrayana, no Dzogchen, none of that, just going back and forth and developing alternately, like pedals on a bicycle, going back and forth between relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta, that takes one countless eon. Okay? Now you're on the eighth. Your mind is completely free of all mental afflictions. The seeds are burned. You'll never experience them ever again. So all you have are the jñāya avarāṇa, the cognitive obscurations, that which stands between you and the complete unveiling of Dharmakaya and the achievement of Buddhahood itself. That takes one countless year. You say, wait a minute, I thought we're almost finished. You know, mental affliction is all finished. How long could this take? One countless year. And you're having a really nice time. I mean, it's really blissful, and you read the descriptions, kind of like your jaw dropped down to your ankles. But it takes one countless year. And not because it's so hard, because it's so subtle. So subtle. And that is just an analogy for this. It's not hard now. You see the pacification of the big nasty upheavals, but it's subtle. And at that point, I really, retrospectively, looking back, at, especially on the last 6 years, it really strikes me that when it's moving along there, it would really, really save you a lot of time to be with a cluster of really dedicated fellow travelers, like your crew on a ship, but also have regular access, really whenever you need it, to a really qualified teacher. You know, I don't care who it is. It's not self-referential. But boy, it really, I've seen this now, and man, it would save you a lot of time. I see this so often now. Whoa. If you'd only had a teacher, somebody in close contact, somebody you're really consulting. Because I've had some students who do very well, and then they don't write to me for months on end. And they know, apart from that 6 months in retreat where I was incommunicado, besides that, I'm really available. And all my students in long-term retreat, they know if they write to me, they'll probably get an answer back within 12 hours and sometimes within 5 minutes, because they're a very high priority for me. I'm trying to take care of them as well as I can. But sometimes they don't write for months on end, which is fine. I don't knock on their door. It's like, hey, why aren't you writing me? I never do that. They need to write to me. But I do see sometimes, oh, what happened? So having a teacher there really would cut this down. So subtle laxity, subtle excitation. Type of mental engagement is interrupted, but not much. It's just these little tweaks of subtle excitation, subtle laxity that's the problem. The quality of experience now is familiarity. You've grown well accustomed to it. Before it was achievement in stage six, now it's familiarity. This is like deep flow, okay? You got flow in stage four. This is deep flow. You're really, you know this practice. And again, now the metaphor here is, once again, involuntary thoughts are like a river slowly flowing through a valley. So that's stage seven. It's very sweet, but it's also very easy to linger there for months on end, because you just haven't quite learned how to sharpen your knife. And so it'd be nice to kind of keep on moving through that. Get the job done so you can establish a new base camp for your ascent to enlightenment, and the base camp being shamatha. So that's that. Stage seven. Enjoy your day. I'll see you later this afternoon.